Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, Deborah Weiss-Ford, managing partner at the law firm of Jackson Lewis, will be our guest, and she's going to be talking about retaliation claims in the workplace. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB, and today we're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford. She's a managing partner at the Portsmouth, New Hampshire office for the attorney law firm of Jackson Lewis. Welcome back, Deb.
Thanks, Dave. Nice to be here.
Yeah, we really enjoy having you on the show. And again, want to thank Jackson Lewis for being a wonderful sponsor of the show. We appreciate it very much.
Our pleasure.
So today we're going to be talking about what I would say is one of the biggest areas that employers are facing today in regards to litigation. That's retaliation claims. We hear a lot about this. One of the things that I'd like to start the show with is if you could explain why is this suddenly becoming, or I won't say suddenly becoming, has become in the last few years, such a big issue?
So you're exactly right about that. Retaliation cases are the most common type of discrimination cases alleged nationally, which tops race, gender, and disability claims. And I think that part of the reason why they're so popular in recent years, first because the legislative and case law developments have broadened the scope of persons protected under retaliation, lowered the burden for establishing unlawful retaliation, and expanded the damages. And when you think of retaliation, you have to keep in mind that virtually all of the anti-discrimination laws contain an anti-retaliation provision. So if you looked at Title VII, if you looked at the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, if you looked at the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, the Family and Medical Leave Act, and on and on and on, all of those laws specifically contain anti-retaliation provisions. And since it is easier now to bring claims, they can be very lucrative for employees or former employees to bring these cases.
So, you know, we obviously know that sometimes the economy has an effect on law in the fact that when people are, you know, going through a recession or, you know, they're really concerned about their income, they look for more ways to have some successful ways of you know, dealing with their employer, especially if they're not happy. Would that be one avenue here in which employers need to really understand that their supervisors, their managers on the line really can make a huge difference in making this a big issue or a small issue?
Absolutely. And I'm sure we'll talk in this hour about training of supervisors, because I do think that what happens in part is that supervisors aren't very familiar with retaliation laws. It appears to be a more amorphous and vague type of topic, and often trainings don't encompass retaliation issues. And since it is now the highest percentage of cases that are brought in discrimination laws, it really behooves employers to make sure that managers are trained regularly on retaliation issues so that managers can identify it and understand that when they take adverse actions, that may have an implication on retaliation statutes. The other thing we should mention, I was just going to say, Dave, other thing we should mention is that because these statutes allow successful plaintiffs to get attorney's fees, that becomes a very attractive avenue for plaintiffs' employment lawyers to bring these cases because it can be lucrative.
You know, you and I have had these conversations, and before we've talked about employers, 99.9%, I believe, want to do the right thing, right? It's not
Absolutely.
Like they're trying to, you know, skirt around these issues. You know, most employers want their employees to be happy at work. They want a fully engaged workforce. The stats don't necessarily live up to the fact that that's currently happening. But they want that. And so I know employers like you do really take it personally when these things happen. right? I mean, they really get upset when they're accused of retaliation, when in, or someone in the management level is accused of retaliation. They do take it personally.
They do, and it's in part how they get into trouble to begin with, because oftentimes the revenge factor, you know, somebody complains about someone and that becomes a thorn in your side, and it sort of is human nature, I think, to take revenge or to treat someone adversely because you're upset about something that they complained about that you think is untrue to begin with. So in part, I think these cases are common sense because they implicate basic human nature and tendencies that all of us have.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it certainly, I always talk about trying to let the emotions calm down when these things happen, right? Because the emotions are just what get you in trouble in the first place. So have a cooling off period, back up, rethink this, talk to somebody, right, before you say something you really wish you shouldn't have.
Exactly. Yeah, that is just so true. And I think if supervisors are trained and understand the laws better, we likely would see a decrease in these type of cases. And that's what the point is. That's what we're trying to show employers, that you can control these likely a lot more than you have been to date.
So let's start with basic stuff. Tell me about the statistics right now in terms of the increased number of claims.
So last year in 2015, the claims, retaliation claims, that were brought under the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission statutes made up 44.5% of all charges, which was an increase from 2014 and from other years in the past as well. There were overall almost 40,000 claims filed nationwide alleging retaliation. So that's a lot. I mean, if you look at race cases, that's 34%. Gender cases are 31%. So to have the retaliation cases being inching up to almost half of the cases just goes to show you that likely it's a training issue for why employers are allowing themselves to get caught up in the retaliation issue.
Are you seeing any difference in locally here in the New England market? Or is it pretty much mirror the national average?
That's a good question. I think it mirrors the national average. I mean, I would say from my practice, probably retaliation cases are somewhere around 40%. So I think that New England is consistent with what is going on nationwide.
Do you see any, as you look at the landscape for, we'll talk about New Hampshire and or Maine in that market, and or any other New England market, you can throw that out there. Do you see any legislative change that could be happening in regards to making it tougher, easier, or anything on the horizon from that perspective?
Well, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court has over the last several years really broadened the coverage and the damages for retaliation cases. There have been a string of cases that have come out of the U.S. Supreme Court that basically have made it easier for employees or former employees to bring suits alleging retaliation. Some of those cases deal with the ability to make an oral complaint as opposed to a written complaint, which was a case from the U.S. Supreme Court that discussed that. In some of the U.S. Supreme Court cases, it has now been made clear that the burden itself is lower to prove these type of issues, basically saying that unlawful retaliation occurs whenever the adverse action or harm would have the effect of discouraging a reasonable employee from making a discrimination complaint. And that's a broad standard. The damage awards can be quite high, compensatory damages, punitive damages, and that always excites plaintiff's lawyers thinking that they'll be able to get some good damages, including attorney's fees. So, yes, the answer to the question is that certainly both on the federal level and on the state level, we have seen an increase in whistleblower cases, and in part that is driven by the ability to get attorney's fees if the plaintiff is successful. So that even if the plaintiff gets a dollar for damages, the attorney's fees would still be paid. So that gives incentive to bring these cases.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I think that's what the bottom line is. All about the money at the end of the day, isn't it, Deb? All about the money.
It's all about the money.
Show me the money. What was that movie? I have to think about that for a minute. Anyways, it's all show about the money. All right, so, you know, one of the things that I know that came up was a recent Walmart verdict. And so why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So the Walmart case happened in New Hampshire, and there was a trial in the New Hampshire federal court. And on January 27, 2016, a New Hampshire federal jury awarded a female pharmacist over $31 million. That's million dollars, which included about $15 million in punitive damages and another $15 million in what they call enhanced compensatory damages. And in that case, the plaintiff, her name was Maureen McPadden, she sued Walmart in, I believe, 2014. And she said that she was fired from her job as a store pharmacist for reporting patient privacy violations. And in part, what she was claiming is that Walmart did not properly train its pharmacists. So she was basically saying that because she complained about that, she was terminated, and that her termination was really due, at least in part, to retaliation for reporting what she considered to be violations of various policies and various laws. So what it did was really highlight, I think, what you and I would call a pretty basic principle of employment law, that an employer has to have a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for taking an adverse employment action against an employee. And in this case, she was terminated in part because she lost a key. And there were some other reasons as well, but she basically said that that reason was pretextual, and the real reason that she was terminated was because she had complained about some issues with safety at the pharmacy. So it just is the verdict is huge. We all expect that it will be reduced, and in part there likely is a Walmart factor. They tend to get hit a bit higher with jury verdicts than some other employers do. But I think the lesson for employers from that is that it's really important that employers have a best practice of requiring a thorough assessment to determine if a decision to terminate is legitimate and can be backed up, and if there's any doubt that it could be looked upon by a jury or a judge as really being for complaining about a protected issue, then the employer needs to step back and take a different course of action.
We're going to talk about it certainly during this hour, but one of the things that is really interesting in the way these are all coming down is that some of the basic handbook language that a lot of employers have been using really needs to be beefed up, doesn't it, in regards to really looked at it in the last few years that it's spot on because of all the changes and all the new acts that are happening out there. Well, you know, are you seeing some language shifting that's happening in terms of the employee handbooks?
Oh, absolutely. It's fairly common to look at a handbook and see nothing in the handbook about retaliation or whistleblowing, how to handle it, what it is, and that is something that I think all management employment lawyers are trying to change, to get those handbooks up to date, to make sure that there is a procedure for the employee to complain, and to make sure that managers know what that procedure is and follow it and deal with the issues.
So one of the things that I know I've heard recently in regards to retaliation is that, and I actually saw this in a handbook where they actually have, and we talked a little bit about it before, a step back period. Like when something is brought forward, that they actually have an actual pause moment, and then they make sure they bring in a third party to make that happen. And I know we're going to talk about some tactics here in a few minutes, but I'm asking only because I've actually seen some language going into handbooks where they actually mandate that. Have you seen that in terms of what you're seeing out there in the marketplace today?
I have, and I see that in handbooks these days occasionally, not a lot, not as much as we would like to see that, but occasionally I see that. And I think for employers who are now attuned to this issue, and sadly sometimes that's because they've been sued and they've been going through the nightmare process of litigation or a claim being filed at a state agency or the EEOC, and when that happens, that tends to spur management training. And that's an issue I'm sure we'll talk about later on, but that is critical that managers understand what retaliation is, what it means, and then when they want to take an adverse action, how do they do that if someone has just complained about some unlawful condition?
We're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford. She's the managing partner at the law firm of Jackson Lewis down in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB and presented by cmacareer.com. And today we're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford. She's the managing partner at the law firm of Jackson Lewis, and we're talking about retaliation claims in the workplace. Well, Deb, again, we've talked a little bit about in the first segment some of the statistics related to retaliation claims. We've talked about the Walmart verdict that has been the most recent case that has certainly created a lot of buzz, let's put it out there, in terms of what's going on. So I think the most logical place to go next is to maybe really talk to the audience about what is the actual law, and then we can get into some tactics as to how to deal with it.
Sure. So the first question is, what is retaliation? And what it means is treating employees badly because they complained about discrimination on the job, or filed a discrimination charge or complaint, or participated in any manner in an employment discrimination proceeding. So that the law is that a manager may not fire, demote, harass, or take some type of adverse action, which is the retaliation, against an individual for filing a complaint of discrimination or participating in a discrimination proceeding or otherwise opposing discrimination. And what employers need to know is that the same laws that prohibit discrimination based on race, color, sex, religion, national origin, age, disability, genetic information, they also prohibit retaliation against individuals who oppose unlawful discrimination or participate in an employment discrimination proceeding. That's the basics law. And so specific examples, Dave, just for example, if an employee testifies against an employer in a coworker complaint and subsequently gets a negative performance review that may affect the person's career advancement, then the employer may have retaliated. That's just a specific example. And there really are three things that have to occur to prove retaliation. So the first is protected activity, and that's either opposition to discrimination or participation in covered proceedings. So one of the things that I think really trips up employers is that the manner of the opposition only has to be reasonable. In other words, it just has to be based on reasonable and good faith belief that an EEOC law was violated. So they don't have to be right. The employee doesn't have to be right. It just has to be a reasonable good faith belief. And that's often a real problem for employers because they think that it can only go forward if the employee was right about the complaint. So, in other words, you could have a complaint being brought alleging an underlying discriminatory act of sexual bias, and maybe that complaint gets thrown out because there's not enough evidence. But the retaliation piece, because the employer acted adversely as a result of the complaint, could still go forward, even though the underlying claim could be dismissed.
You know, before we get into the other two, one of the areas that employers struggle with is, and they get what I call a little bit gun-shy. So you have an employee who is marginal, right? Marginal improvement, marginal issue. Something occurs, but they're going to get a, maybe they're going to be put on a PIP, or they're going to be put on a performance, you know, improvement plan, a PIP, or they're going to get a disciplinary action. But something occurs which creates an event which, if they do that PIP or they do that performance evaluation, the employee may perceive it to be retaliation, even though it was already in the works coming forward, but just hadn't been issued. This is what we call the real life, as you know, of what happens to an employer. How do employers deal with that? And how do they, because then they get scared. They're like, well, wait, I really can't give the performance improvement. I'm going to have to hold off. And then I get how long, and then I got to tolerate that employee. I mean, that's obviously real life of things that happened.
Right. Right. Yeah. So that's exactly the difficulty of this specific area of law. So that any time you have a complaint that falls within these protected categories, and let's say you want to take some type of adverse action against the employee for something completely unrelated, tardiness issues or performance issues, attitude issues, whatever it may be. The issue becomes that if that is not well documented, if the infraction is not well documented, and if it appears to be more Mickey Mouse and not a real infraction, then what the employee begins to think is that it's really because I complained about a safety issue or a gender discrimination issue or a race issue or whatever the protected category may be. And so the issue becomes, is it pretext? Are you just making up a reason, some Mickey Mouse reason, to take adverse action when really you are upset as the employer that I filed a complaint about gender discrimination, just for example? So what does that mean? That means that what the employer must do is, first of all, have a process so that the employer is aware and has documented the infraction that the plaintiff or the employee is complaining about. And that becomes an issue. If you're a large employer and, I complain to my manager and the manager doesn't tell HR and then adverse action is taken against me, I'm saying that I complained about it and you must have told other people about it, but there's no trail. So in other words, it really needs to be, the complaint itself needs to be documented and needs to be investigated. And that piece of it has to be done. And then you need to look at the subsequent infraction, why you're on the PIP, what the specific infraction is, whether it's attitude or performance, and you have to make sure that that is enough of an infraction for you to take adverse action and that you have done that consistently with other employees. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I mean, it absolutely does make sense, and I think that's where the employers get, or supervisors sometimes get hung up, right? They don't necessarily write everything down. They don't necessarily communicate enough with HR, or if it's a smaller employer, with the owner or other things of what's going on. And I think that's, at the end of the day, which we're going to be talking about tactics here in a few minutes, it's about communication, right? It's about having that paper trail, that communication between supervisors and owners to make this work, or you could get yourself in a lot of trouble.
Absolutely. So you have to investigate the underlying complaint. Whatever the employee is complaining about in terms of the protected activity, that needs to be investigated thoroughly and documented thoroughly so that you can look back and know exactly what you did and why you did what you did. And then when you're looking at the adverse action, you'd have to figure out whether that is action that you would take regardless of whether the employee had complained or not. And circling back to the Walmart case, that was one of the issues, because in that case, the plaintiff, the pharmacist, said that she was punished much more severely than her similarly situated male colleagues, and that in part, the action taken against her was because of her gender. And so that's an issue that employers, in my mind, always have to think about: consistency And would I do this regardless of whether the person made a complaint? And have I done that consistently in the past, regardless of gender or race or disability?
Well, when we're talking about the law, you said there were three things that you have to worry about. The first one is protected activity.
Right.
What is the second and third?
The second one is adverse action, so that any action that may deter a reasonable person from protected activity is actionable. So adverse actions are things like firing, materially affecting the terms or conditions of employment, demoting, not giving a promotion, putting somebody on the night shift, transferring them to some remote location where you know they need to travel 2 hours to get there. Anything that can be deemed to be adverse would fall under this category. And then the third piece of it is the causal connection. And that's the causal connection between the protected activity and the adverse action. There has to be some reason to believe that the adverse action was taken because of the protected activity. So those are the three elements for proving retaliation.
So is the onus on the employer or the employee in regards to proof?
The onus is on the employee to prove it, although the burdens, as you know, in employment law, burdens often shift. And for some pieces of it, the employer would need to meet the burden. But for the most part, the burden is on the employee.
Okay, that's good. So let's talk about some tactics now. Now that we've kind of gone through what the law is, let's talk about some common tactics that we can use and some training that we can do in regards to helping employers deal with this, you know, growing area.
Sure. So common tactics are many, many things. There's a long list. I mean, there's a list of 12 or 15 different tactics, so we can hit some of them. These are things that employees complain about. In other words, what they're saying is that adverse action was taken because they made a claim of some type of protected activity, and when they did that, adverse action was taken. And those typical tactics are leaving somebody out. In other words, excluding the person who complained from decisions and work activity by supervisors or management. So that being left out and going in conjunction with that is a cold shoulder. Employees who complain say that they get the cold shoulder by other workers because they become the tattletale, if you will, and sometimes that that can lead to some adverse actions in the workplace.
So, you know, one of the things that employers have been talking a lot about is how they can train their supervisors. We talked about it, obviously, in the last segment, and I kind of hone in on this today. You know, I know employers already do sexual harassment training, you know, sometimes workplace violence training or OSHA training, and they certainly do, you know, training having to do with the supervisors on many different things. How does retaliation training fit into this, you know, area of employer training that really needs to be done?
Sure. So it's similar, I think, to anti-harassment training that is done. And for me, I do it in conjunction with anti-harassment training. In other words, I'm giving training to managers and supervisors on what types of conduct constitute retaliation, how to respond when a complaint is brought. So I go through the retaliation laws, and I give very specific examples of common retaliatory measures that are taken against employees when they make a complaint, and then a training with what to do when you get those complaints. What's the procedure? What does your policy say? How should you be dealing with this? How should you be treating the employee? If you are going to take adverse action, make sure that it is documented. Make sure that it is consistent. You need to talk about the period of time. That's a big issue. What's the period of time? I mean, if I make a complaint to you as my employer about some type of race discrimination, and the very next day you want to reprimand me because I didn't do a project well, should you do that? Should you do it the very next day? Should you wait to do that? How should you handle it? And that's the type of training that I think you need to give to your managers.
You know, as we talked about, again, having to do with the last segment, we talked about employers just dealing with that specific issue. You know, timing is everything in life. But timing is even more important when you're dealing with retaliation issues and how people perceive what is happening versus maybe what really is happening, actually can make a huge difference in the way that you're able to present your case should it move forward.
Absolutely. I think you have to really closely review any subsequent employment actions that you take which are adverse to an employee, justified or not. You have to consider that the employee made a protected claim and that what you do, the adverse action that you take on the employee, legitimate or not, but you have to assume that that later could be looked upon or judged to see if the action was legitimate, was based on your policies, was consistent with how you have done past performance improvement issues with other employees. So you really need to go through all of those very specific questions before you go ahead and take the adverse action.
Yeah, this is probably the most frustrating part to employers, right? I mean, this single-handedly is the stuff that drives some of them crazy because it's just like, well, why do I have to be so, quote-unquote, careful when this individual has still performance issues? How do you kind of have that conversation with them to make employers understand why that's the way it has to be?
Yeah, so that's a great point. So I'm sure that you get this all the time. The comment to me is always, hey, we're at will, so I can do whatever I want to do.
That's so true. Hear it all the time. Hear it all the time.
Every day. I don't know if a day goes by where I don't hear it's at will, so why do I need to know about all this? And of course, the answer to the question is that, yes, most states are at will, and most employees are at will if they don't have a contract. But there are so many exceptions to the at will doctrine, of course, that these things do matter, and that employers need to understand that although an employee may be at will, that doesn't give an employer a license to retaliate, to engage in prohibited activity, to discriminate or harass based on a protected class. So to me, that's how I always start out my training. I mean, I meet that head on because I know I'm going to get that question anyway. So that's how I start the training, by explaining what that means and by explaining why these laws matter.
Let's be honest, Deb. We get that question no matter what we're training, right? That's the bottom line. It's the first question that comes out of everybody's mouth.
When I get it at the end of the session, it worries me more than when I get it at the beginning of the
You're
session.
Exactly right. You're exactly right. We're talking with Deborah Weiss Ford. She's the managing partner at the law firm of Jackson Lewis. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. And we will be right back. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello. I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAKorea.com. And today we're talking with Deb Weiss Ford. She is the attorney at law down at Jackson Lewis Law Firm and managing partner in the Portsmouth office in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. But I know you do more than just New Hampshire, Deb. You are across the country, are you not?
We are. So we are about 800 lawyers across the country. We have, I believe it's up to 57 offices. And in the office in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, we also cover Maine, Vermont, do some work in Massachusetts as well, and New Hampshire, of course.
Of course. No, and there's a lot going on, so you're always, always busy.
Always busy. All we do is work.
All we do is work, as I know the great logo. That's it. That's it. Or tagline, actually, not logo. All right, so we're talking about retaliation claims in the workplace. And, you know, we're kind of talking about some of the training and development. What are some of the common retaliation tactics that are out there today?
So the things that we see most, and in other words, this is when an employee makes a complaint that there is some type of unlawful activity going on in the workplace, you know, be it gender discrimination or race discrimination or something along those lines. And as a result, the manager says, gee, thanks a lot, you're fired, or you won't get this specific promotion, or you're going to have a pay cut, or we're going to downgrade your position. Those are the type of tactics, retaliation tactics, that we commonly see. It's not always the tactic to terminate someone. Sometimes the tactic is more for demotion or putting you on a night shift or, you know, as I said earlier, putting you in some remote location that is difficult to get to and is just undesirable. And those are the type of abuses that we see as a result of employees reporting violations or other wrongdoings that would fall under the retaliation provisions.
So, you know, when an employer is dealing with these things, and let's look at it from this standpoint. So an employer is, something happens, and somebody makes a claim. What's the process? What happens from there? What do employers have to, A, know what the process is, B, what paperwork might be coming, what from what agency, what division of government? Kind of give a process explanation so that listeners can understand how it works.
Sure. So what would happen is, let's say that you're the employer and I'm the employee, and I come to you and I say that I think that there is a gender discrimination issue in the workplace, that my male colleague who sits next door to me is getting better work assignments. I heard that he makes more money. And in essence, he's getting better job benefits than I am getting. You as the manager should first of all be what I call punting that to HR and letting HR deal with the issue. And if there is no HR, then as the manager, you need to do an investigation and figure out if my complaints have merit or don't have merit. And if my complaints have merit, there needs to be some type of a process that you deal with the pay inequity or the gender discrimination or whatever the specific violation is that I, in good faith, am telling you about and reporting to you. So that's the first step. Then what has to happen is that I need to be assured that I'm not going to be retaliated against because I brought forward some type of good faith unlawful activity. And if something should happen in the future, whether it be the next day, the next week, 3 months, 6 months later, but if something should happen and I don't perform my job well, as the manager or HR, you need to be thinking about, am I going to be able to show that I'm really getting a demotion or getting terminated or some type of adverse action because I made this gender discrimination and pay inequity claim to you? And you must be able to show that whatever action you're taking, whether it's a demotion or a change in a job classification, you have to be able to justify that on its own merits so that it doesn't look like it's pretextual.
So when an employer is dealing with responding to the complaint, at what point should HR or what point should a owner get legal advice?
So I think it really depends. I'll give you a lawyer answer. It really depends on the circumstances.
I would expect nothing less.
And it does. I mean, some HR departments are very sophisticated, really are familiar with these issues, know how to handle these issues, know how to do an investigation, and have a great deal of competency and sophistication in dealing with this. And if that is the case, then I think it's fine for the HR department to go ahead and do the investigation and make sure that the managers understand that no retaliation can occur. On the other hand, if you have you don't have an HR department or you're unfamiliar with this type of complaint, you haven't been through this before, you haven't had training, then it's advisable to reach out to your employment lawyer to find out the process that you should go through to document the specific actions that you're taking.
Yeah, I want to just highlight a little bit on the word investigation, because what is your take in terms of a third-party investigation versus an internal investigation, and whether or not from a credibility standpoint, or whether it helps you if you do litigate or hurts you?
Another lawyer answer, it depends. And it really does depend. So if some investigations certainly can be done by an HR department or someone in the organization who is trained on how to do a proper investigation, and that's the critical issue. Whoever is doing the investigation must be specifically trained on the elements of a proper investigation. If there is someone in the organization that is comfortable with that, that is familiar with the process and understands how it needs to be done, then it's fine to have someone do that in-house. But if you have people who are not trained, who don't have that level of sophistication, or if the complaint is about a superior, so let's say that the complaint is about the CEO of the company, then you don't want HR to do that investigation because HR reports to the CEO. And no one should be doing an investigation who reports to the person who's being investigated. Then certainly you would want to step out and do a third-party investigation.
You know, we talked about at the beginning of this show why the jury appeal, why there's so much quote-unquote money to be dealt with in terms of this. You know, one of the things that I would say, and I'm sure you will agree with because you hear it as well, most employers, as we said, want to treat their employees well. This is when something goes askew. And as you know, it can happen quickly. That's the part that sometimes surprises employers, is how fast things can turn from an employee who is really excited to be there to something has happened. And it can be one incident, or it could be multiple incidents. You know, speak to that discussion point of trying to be consistent across your organization to make those cases that, hey, this is not what's happening here.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and it was one of the basis for the very large Walmart verdict. And you know, I'll answer the question by giving you a quick story of a case I handled last year. And that was a case where a woman on an assembly line expressed some violent comments to a male co-worker. Said some things that were inappropriate. The employer had a workplace violence policy, as many employers do today, and basically it was a zero tolerance policy. And so when these comments were made threatening a co-worker, the female employee who made the comments was terminated. She brought a lawsuit claiming gender discrimination, and the issue was that she said that a male employee had a year prior to that made some comments about another employee threatening to harm or kill that employee and had only been given a warning and hadn't been terminated. And so she said that terminating her for the violent comments was really retaliation against her gender because the male employee was treated differently. And these are the kinds of issues that the employer needs to think about when it's deciding whether to take adverse action. So something that seemingly was a good idea, and I think a lot of employers would agree that you should terminate when someone makes threatening, violent comments about another employee, that got turned around because it hadn't been treated consistently with in prior occasions. At least that was the allegation.
So I'm just going to throw out a question in regards to that. Employers have the right to change and modify their policies or their procedures or their handbook at any time. And so how does that affect the consistency rule, right? That everything is being consistent, but now we're treating someone different because we're changing the rules.
Right. That's an excellent question. And so what should happen is that employers should understand they're not always stuck with the same thing. They can change rules, they can change policies, but when they do that, they need to make sure that employees are alerted that there is a change. And whether that's a discussion about a change in a handbook or a change in a policy, employees need to be notified that, yes, we did it this way in the past, but going forward, this is the way we're going to do it. And that's all perfectly permissible. You're not stuck in something that is not working for you. You can change it, but when the policy is disseminated, there must be communication that this is a change.
We're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford. She's the managing partner at the law firm Jackson Lewis. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford, managing partner at Jackson Lewis Law Firm, and we're talking about retaliation claims in the workplace. Deb, I think this has been a really educational program in regards to, you know, what's really going on out there and how we can look at it in different ways. But I really think we should end the show on how to reduce exposure to retaliation claims. So I know you have 5 steps. Why don't you talk about those, and then we'll wrap it up.
Sure. So the first step would be to implement a policy specifically prohibiting unlawful retaliation. Most employers in this day and age have policies that deal with anti-discrimination and harassment policies. If those policies do not specifically address retaliation, then employers should amend the current policies to include a very strong zero-tolerance non-retaliation statement. It can either be an amendment to your existing policy, or you could have a separate, specific policy dealing with retaliation issues.
Okay, that's number one. Let's go to number two.
Number two, training. Training, training, training. You have got to train managers and supervisors so that they understand what it means. And by that I mean, what's the non-retaliation policy, how does it work, what does it mean, and how should it be applied? So training should constitute retaliation pieces, how to respond to it when a complaint is brought, and importantly, the training should be documented, so if needed, an employer can later show the steps that were taken to prevent the unlawful retaliation. Me, I like to have employees sign in when they are getting trained so that we have a record of which managers were trained. And I think it's important to make sure that all of that is documented. Also, that's general training that should be done on a yearly basis anyway, as at the same time that you do your anti-harassment, anti-discrimination training. But further, when you get an actual claim that is being made, somebody is a whistleblower or somebody is complaining about some unlawful protected activity, then there should be specific training at that time to the managers involved so that they understand that they can't retaliate and they understand for that specific claim what they can and can't do.
So we've talked about amending the policies to make sure they're right for retaliation. We're talking about training, training, training. What's the third step?
Not to ignore or isolate claimants. It becomes rather typical, and I suppose it's just a human nature to ostracize or isolate employees who make complaints about activity in the workplace. They get ignored. They're not treated the same as other employees, and that generally makes employees feel that they're being retaliated against and run to a lawyer or make some more complaints because they feel they're not being treated the same as everyone else. So the employer, if a claim comes in about a protected activity that an employee feels in good faith is wrong, then the employer should provide the claimant with a copy of the policy, offer to assist the claimant if he or she experiences problems, document that discussion, and follow up. And that's one of the things I think that employers often don't do. They don't follow up. They have an initial discussion, and then they never follow up to make sure that the employee is not experiencing any retaliation. And document, document, document.
Okay, and the next one is?
The next one would be to consider some other protective measures, restructuring the work environment. I mean, you never want to take adverse action against the person who's making the complaint, but maybe there's a coworker who is the offender, and maybe you want to, if you're not going to terminate, you want to change supervisors, change work schedule, do something to assist the employee who is making the good faith complaint.
And finally...
And then finally is the subsequent employment actions that we've talked about. So this is when you have an issue with the employee that occurs after the employee has made a good faith complaint. And subsequently, whether it's a day or a week or 6 months later, you want to take an adverse employment action, maybe a performance improvement plan or a termination or a demotion. Then the employer must make sure that they thoroughly review the action that they want to take to make sure that the employee is being treated consistently with other employees, and to document that, and to make sure that any action you're taking is because of the specific action and not tied into the complaint that was made about the protected activity.
Deb, these have been great tips. I think that they really are something that employers need to seriously take and actually implement. Because you know what I find, as I'm sure you do as well, while employers have the best intentions, sometimes they look at these things and they go, yeah, I'll get to them. And they don't necessarily always implement everything that needs to be implemented. Because some of it costs money and some of it takes time. And heck, I just want to make widgets or I just want to do what I need to do.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things that if we can, you know, can really emphasize here today between you and I having this conversation, that it is serious and the amount of time and money it takes to do this is a whole heck of a lot less than if you have to go to court.
Absolutely. I mean, these are, and you really feel for managers and supervisors. They have a job to do. They're busy. This legal information is very complicated. It can turn on you on a dime, and the consequences are pretty severe. It can be very, very costly. Plus, the publicity is never a good thing for an employer. So I completely agree with that statement.
We've been talking about retaliation claims in the workplace. Deborah Weiss Ford, thank you so much for being on the show today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And now the HR tip of the week. Today we're going to be having it done by Deborah Weiss Ford, managing partner and attorney at law at Jackson Lewis Law Firm. Deborah, what's the tip of the week?
Tip of the week, spring cleaning. So it's just around the corner. May not feel like it, but spring is coming, and that means update your handbook. So you want to go through your handbook, make sure that it's updated with both federal and state law, and importantly, any practice that you have adopted that's not in your handbook or something that you don't want to do anymore, spring cleaning, take it out or put it back in. But look at those handbooks and make sure they're up to date.
And that's your HR tip of the week. Next week on the HR Power Hour, Stephen Barton of Barton Business Coaching talks about the Game of 10. The Game of 10 is a new conflict resolution game that is a simple method of shifting your awareness to change. Next, we're going to have Jane Carpenter. She's the owner of Maine Identity Services, and she is going to remind us why data breaches and identity theft are still a big threat to your organization, and especially HR. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.